is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign, providing trophies, plaques, and awards for sports teams, business teams, and many others. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we're going to take a look at American history through the eyes of our closest and oldest animal companion, the dog. Mark Durr is our guest. He is the author of A Dog's History of America, How Our Best Friend Explored, Conquered, and Settled a Continent. Let me share with you an excerpt from the description of the book. For thousands of years, dogs were the only domesticated animals of most Native Americans, serving as companions, hunters, beasts of burden, and guards. With the arrival of Christopher Columbus, greyhounds, mastiffs, and several other breeds were introduced to the Americas and played a gruesome role in the conquest, as well as a formative one in the establishment of sheep herding. English colonists relied on them to power machinery and for hunting, protection, and managing livestock. Along the ever-expanding frontier, dogs were ubiquitous as the constant companions of hunters like Daniel Boone, as essential guardians and helpers of the farmers who followed them, as an integral part of the Lewis and Clark expedition, and of Custer's campaigns, and later in capturing runaway slaves. The book takes readers up to the very present when dogs serve in many roles. They continue, of course, to be companions. They're treated as one of the family. But dogs also continue to work. They have jobs in defense and law enforcement. You may also find them in hospitals, nursing homes, and prisons, where they play a role in healing and rehabilitation. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to hearing from you. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Mark Durr is a regular contributor to the science section of the New York Times. His previous books include Some Kind of Paradise, A Social and Environmental History of Florida, and Dog's Best Friend. His new book, A Dog's History of America, is published by the North Point Press, a division of Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Mark Durr, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me, Celeste.
Sure. Was it your book, Dog's Best Friend, that got you thinking about dogs in history?
Well, in part it was. I had encountered many of the stories of dogs around the world, and it occurred to me that what had been unwritten, left untold, really, was what dogs had actually done on a more detailed level. I thought initially that I could perhaps tackle a history of dogs in the world, but that's too broad a subject. It would take many volumes. Then I thought I would do the Americas in general, but that, too, is too broad a subject because different cultures have used dogs in different ways.
Yeah. You note early in the book that dogs have been at once ubiquitous and invisible in our history. If we were to imagine our history without dogs, what might we imagine?
Now, that's a very good question. I think we would be majorly impoverished. For one thing, the Native Americans would have lacked virtually their only domesticated animal for thousands of years. The dog literally carried their camps around. It served as food when on ceremonial occasions or in times of need. Sometimes it was a regular part of the diet. It was their guardian, their hunting companion. Some dogs were trained to fish. Some dogs were raised purely for their hair, so it could be woven into clothes. So that in that whole society, which existed in North America for thousands of years, perhaps tens of thousands of years before Europeans came, the dog was a central part of society. It's simply hard to imagine what people would have been like without dogs. When the Europeans came, they brought their dogs with them. The amazing thing is, perhaps one way to think about it is that the dog may have separated from the wolf some 30,000 years ago or longer, and basically co-evolved with modern what we think of as modern humans.
Yeah.
So to think of us without dogs is to virtually rewrite our entire prehistory and history.
Yeah. You say you're sure that dogs will be around if we are. They are too valuable in all regards to give up. They are too much a part of who we are. You know, we breed dogs, we train them. Has the dog given shape to our nature in any way?
Well, I think the dog has. I noticed there's a paper that someone is delivering in the Netherlands. I haven't seen the paper, but he suggests that dogs use humans as tools. I think any dog owner knows that at a very basic level, the dog perhaps trains them as much as they train the dog. So there is that element of it. The other thing is that the dog, in a very real way, extends our senses. The way to think about it is that the dog smells things that are well beyond our grasp. It sees it in a different way than we do, and it hears frequencies that we don't hear. So in that way, it becomes both a complement and an aid to us, and we simply, if you grow to depend on a dog, then you reach a point, I think, where you can't easily do without it. That said, there also are people who simply don't like dogs, even despise them. And so our society is torn. Sometimes communities are torn right down the middle. And I think part of this is related to the fact that although the dog is a domestic animal and has been for thousands of years, and humans have shaped it literally and figuratively through selective breeding, it retains an element of the wild. In a very real sense, it's our connection to the wild, especially as we have moved into these megalopolises, you know, which have very few parks or natural settings around them. And the dog, like the cat, but even more so the dog, I think, remains our connection to another species.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Mark Durr, our guest this afternoon. We already have a listener lined up ready to talk with us this afternoon, so let's go to this caller in Indiana, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I hope you can give me some information on this. Not trying to be critical, but certainly it's an interesting question to me, and I haven't gotten anywhere further on thinking about it. In terms of dogs and neighborhoods, I live in a neighborhood where I have one fellow that's a coon hunter, and he doesn't really care too much about whether his dogs bay at night or not, and just seems to be presenting a little problem for the neighborhood, but nothing but big deal. But on one side of my house, I had a Rottweiler who, first few times he saw me, if he hadn't been on a chain, he'd probably, pick me up in pieces. Eventually, he just sort of looks up at me and, oh, there's that guy again. And on the other side of me, I got a Rottweiler that, over a period of a year now, he's just like, I'm the new fella, just showed up, and I got to be torn to pieces. And I've noticed this in some dogs. Eventually, I thought it was just in standpoint of ignorance, but some dogs get used to you, and other ones don't. And there's no change in my behavior. I don't go up and pet them or, say hi there or anything like that. I just walk back and forth to my garage. I'm just wondering if you have any idea what's the commonality here. The only thing I can offer you is that I've got two dogs from the same group, at least, the Rottweilers, but their behavior is entirely different over a long period of time to, just one person walking back and forth.
Well, it's a good observation. It's well documented that it's a little complicated sometimes for people to understand, because they like to think of breeds as having a particular kind of behavior. That's the popular notion, Labradors swim and retrieve. But it's been documented by study after study that there is greater variety between dogs within a certain breed, say between individual Rottweilers, in behavior than there is between, say, Rottweilers and Labradors. And so you're going to get that kind of variability. The other unfortunate thing is that many dog behaviorists will tell you that Rottweilers have been ruined, as it were. There are a lot of Rottweilers out there that just have a very aggressive streak, a very nasty aggressive streak. And part of it is that they've been overbred as they've become popular.
Yeah. You know, in our recent history, we've seen fashions in dogs. Certain breeds become very popular. Then their popularity may fade. Is this a relatively recent phenomenon, or does it go all the way back?
Well, breeds themselves, as we conceive of them, only go back about 200 years. They really originated in the late 18th century, most of them in the 19th century. And by a breed, I mean there is a closed breeding colony for the dogs, which is maintained through a registry, through a pedigree. And also there is a kind of written description of what the dog is to look like, and both of these things are used to measure what breed you have. People have always, I think, bred to one degree or another, selected for certain characteristics that they might want in a dog, be it tameness, for example. The other caller was just talking about aggression. Some people want aggressive dogs. Some people want dogs that are not aggressive. Now, breeding is not an exact science, so you're always going to get that mix of animals. But it's traditionally what would happen when people got dogs that they didn't want is that they would remove them from the gene pool. Quite literally, they would probably kill them. Now what happens is that the dog is often neutered or put up for adoption or some other way kept out of the breeding colony. That's ideal. In practice, of course, there are a lot of people who are just into it for the money, and so they breed a dog that's, say, a Cocker Spaniel without any attention to the finer points of temperament or even the looks of the dog or its physical health. So I suppose that the answer to your question is people have always, to one degree or another, shape the dog to their needs and desire. In the past, say, 150 to 200 years, we've done it to a degree that is basically beyond anything that's happened in history.
Yeah. One more kind of a behavior question here, going back and tying this up with history. The Puritans, I learned in A Dog's History of America, were interested not only in policing the behavior of one another, they also paid attention to the behavior of one another's dogs. So in the minds of the Puritans, what made a dog valuable? What was construed as bad behavior?
Well, there were some churches, for example, where dogs were allowed in to keep their masters and mistresses' feet warm during those long Puritan services. And if the dogs got too raucous by barking or otherwise creating a fuss, there were people with whips who would drive them from the church. In other terms, they certainly would not want the animal killing livestock, for example. That would be a capital offense. The dog could be hung, just as witches were hanged. So there was that kind of enforcement of rules of behavior that is common throughout the colonial period, actually, where free-ranging dogs could be a major problem. In cities, for example, like New York, livestock was being driven into the city for slaughter, which happened on a regular basis, the free-ranging dogs, the stray dogs, or the dogs that were owned and just let to run outside, would often attack those animals and kill them. And on occasion, the drives had to be suspended just because of that. So there's always that effort, not just among the Puritans, but among other people, to regulate the behavior of the dog. And what is considered good behavior changes over time. By the middle 19th century, you have people writing regularly in the popular magazines that it is time to civilize the dog, which is to say that it's supposed to be trained to live in the city. And remember, at that time, urbanization was increasing apace, and the dog was making the transition, which really few other animals could make, from being a farm dog, from being a country dog, to being a city dog. Same yeah. transition people had to make.
Yeah. And when you think of it, I'm thinking now of California, the city of Los Angeles, when it was very young in the mid-19th century. Dogs outnumbered people 2-1.
Yes, there were more dogs than people, in fact. But you have a freely breeding population.
Yeah.
It's rather like feral cats today in some areas.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the numbers just get out of control. They don't live very long, and they can be prone to all kinds of diseases, but in fact they were so numerous in places like Los Angeles that occasionally they would be rounded up and killed.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on a cell phone, line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. We have an Australian Shepherd. I think he's about 6 years old, and we're going to get a puppy probably next month, another Australian Shepherd. I was wondering if you could tell us the pros and cons of having Australian Shepherds. We don't have a fenced-in yard. We live out in the country, and we have three kids. The dog we have now is really, really good about boundaries and staying with the kids. Does that run true for all of them or not?
Well, I think that in general, dogs will roam, especially male dogs who have their testicles. One way to do that is to neuter them. I don't know what the laws are, the situation is where you live, but many places don't look kindly anymore to dogs that roam around. So it's the obligation of the people to keep them either fenced or in the house. It sounds like you're pretty responsible. The key thing is that when a dog is running freely, and I've had bitter experiences this way when I was younger, it has a risk of running in front of a car, and then you end up with a dead dog.
Mm.
And this happened to me for one dog I had when my father was walking it off-leash after I had gone to college, and it happened right after I was out of college with a dog, a young pointer who was an adopted dog who escaped, ran across an 18-hole golf course and a mile further on, probably chasing a dog in heat and on a snowy day, and ended up under the wheels of a car dead. I think once that happens, you don't want it to happen again ever.
Oh. Also, this listener, she might want to tune in. We do a program here on the first Friday of the month at this point in the day when we talk with dog trainers. We have two dog trainers that join us, and they might really be able to give you some insights as well in terms of the questions that you raise here this afternoon.
I didn't quite answer her question. I would comment about Australian Shepherds and herding dogs in general.
Okay.
And that is that they require a lot of activity, as she knows, and her children are probably the best thing to keep a dog in motion. And the other thing is that they are, if they're bred from working stock especially, they will be highly reactive. And if they see something they consider herdable or chaseable, there's a high likelihood that they will go after it.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Mark Durr. He is the author of A Dog's History of America, How Our Best Friend Explored, Conquered, and Settled a Continent. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, when did dogs appear in North America? Did they arrive with people?
I think that it's a pretty safe assumption, and there's no solid archaeological evidence for it, but in terms of what remains there are and the dating and the what we know about the origin of dogs, it's pretty safe to say that dogs probably came with the first bands of hunting and gathering people who crossed the Bering Land bridge. into North America. The date you can choose from among a number of them, but it was probably at least 15,000 years ago, and perhaps longer. And the reason I say that is because as soon as the dog came into existence, that is, as soon as these tame wolves became dogs through a kind of process that is still not understood, they spread throughout human societies, either by trade or by breeding of some few dogs that people might have had with wolves. And they were just too useful to let go. There have been studies showing, for example, that among hunting and gathering people, the men who use, I say men because the men were the hunters in almost all cases, the men who used dogs brought in 75% of the meat that the band consumed.
Very important. You know, dogs have been such a boon for humankind. One thinks of their ability to protect as helpers in hunting, able to carry a pack. And if you have a team, they can serve as a taxi. When did the dog become valued for companionship?
Well, I think that the dog always was valued for companionship. That said, of course, the way that it's treated varies from culture to culture. But you can go back in records to see that people cared mightily for their dogs, even in pre-Columbian days, pre-Columbus days here in the United States or in North America. And I think that was always a function. Part of the decision, of course, is what the dog is good for. I mean, some dogs simply are layabouts. The Navajo, for example, whom I observe with their little sheepdogs, they use small dogs that are raised with sheep to guard their flocks, have a way of saying that there are sheepdogs. Those are the ones who stay with the flock all the time. There are dogs that aren't sheepdogs, and there are sometimes sheepdogs. They'll kind of go between the worlds of the sheep and the human. So I think that what happens in the initial sorting is that the dogs who really weren't good for anything, and you can read accounts of this among Plains Indians when they were on the move with their whole villages, the dogs being packed and the women carrying their burden and the men kind of off on the side, that there often were dogs who simply would not carry packs, and they were there too. In fact, they would create quite a ruckus because they occasionally would charge into the fully loaded animals and wreak havoc, and you'd have a riot of dogs and people as the women would wade in to break up the fights. So in some cases these dogs were probably kind of outsiders, and in others I think they were probably favored animals for one reason or another.
Yeah. You mentioned the sheepdogs and Native Americans. This was interesting to read how some sheepdogs were actually weaned on sheep so that they felt themselves part of the sheep. That's very clever.
Yes, this was the Spanish the method that the Spaniards brought with when they brought livestock here. And it was practiced in South America. As I said, the Navajo still practice it, and the notion is that the dog is virtually raised with the sheep, raised, weaned by a sheep, and they grow to, I think it's debatable as to whether they grow to think of themselves as sheep or the sheep as dogs, but I tend to think they probably think of the sheep as dogs, or if not dogs, then at least their immediate family, let us say. And it's this method was highly successful for some time. It's been adopted in kind of modified fashion in recent years by farmers and ranchers who want guard dogs to protect their sheep from coyotes.
Let's talk with another listener, a listener in Belgium on the toll-free line, line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. The question I'm going to ask you folks is along that same sort of lines you just touched there. Just when did people start thinking that dogs had to think more like people than they do like dogs? you see a lot of people say, oh, little Fluffy, isn't she so kind and so nice, and give her a lot of human traits, or any other dog for that matter, too, when really, wouldn't it be a lot easier to deal with your dog if you think more like a dog than trying to make the dog think like a human?
Well, I always say that dogs probably understand us far better than we understand dogs. I think you make a very good point. It became common in the late 19th century in France and in England and in the United States, especially in the cities, for people with these small dogs, these purebred small dogs, to host formal dinners for them or stage weddings for them or any number of other things. There also was a tendency among breeders to create, you still see some of these dogs like the pug and others, small dogs with a kind of punched-in nose and eyes more forward, more binocular eyes that actually have a more kind of human-like appearance. And this was related to what I said earlier about the need that some people perceive to civilize the dog, which was to make it more human so that it could behave and act properly in human society. In general, I would agree with you that the people who succeed best with their dogs are, in fact, the people who respect the dog's integrity and try to understand it and find out what motivates it and what it and understand what it needs. And among the things it needs, of course, are exercise and fair treatment.
Yeah, as Ms. Inge and I, pardon me, Ms. Quinn and I have spoke at different times with the other people she has for dogs. If you take a dog when he's born, and not many people can do this, but when you take a dog when he's born, and just as soon as the mother breathes on his dog, you breathe on the dog too. And you keep that dog like that, and you keep associating your smells with the dog never leaves you. The dog will stay right beside you. It thinks of you as much, if not more, as a dog than it does itself. And a lot of people forget that you have to socialize a dog in that way to make him do what you want him to do.
Well, I think you're basically, your methodology is somewhat akin to what the people who raise sheepdogs by raising them with sheep rather than humans. It's a form of imprinting.
Exactly right, sir.
Most study, first of all, I have to say that honestly, I wouldn't want a dog that stayed on my heel all the time. It would make me feel like the dog was a little too dependent and needy. But beyond that, what you're really talking about is socialization, and it's well documented that there is a crucial socialization period for dogs. It tends to run from about 14 weeks. The problem with handling newborn puppies, of course, is that they're very fragile. And I think that if you were to just take the puppy when it was weaned, with about 7 weeks or so, and raise it and socialize it to both dogs and people, you would find that it was a wonderful creature too. The signal point here is that dogs need to be socialized. They need to learn how to live in whatever society they're in. And you see it all the time. If a dog is raised in a kennel, for example, until it's a year old or so, and then you try to take it into your home, often you have your hands full because the dog simply doesn't know how to behave. It's not a question of training so much as it's a question of learning. I think there's a difference there. And when a dog starts out as a puppy associating with people, it learns the rules of behavior the same way it learns the rules of behavior with its litter mates and other young dogs through play, through all kinds of social interactions.
That's precisely what I was getting at. When I said it doesn't leave you, I don't mean it's actually at your heels all the time, but if you call it, it will come back to you. It's much more socialized to you than it is to other dogs, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, well, what you've really done is you've taught the dog. Handling puppies is even from an early age, I don't think, is a problem as long as it's not overdone. There are people who have all kinds of notions. I knew someone once who thought the puppy should be taken almost as soon as it was born and turned upside down. I don't know, it seemed to be a peculiar notion that it would stimulate its brain or something. But as I said, what you're really talking about is a process by which the dog learns how to behave. And much of that is what people used to call yard training, you know, teaching a dog to come, to sit, to stay. But if you're with it from the time it's weaned, basically, you're teaching it without actually going through the process of training. I mean, those are things that should be natural to dogs. And in fact, dogs at a young age usually want to follow or come. So it's just a question of reinforcing their natural inclination. And the best way to do that, of course, is to treat them kindly and to praise them.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener, a caller on a cell phone in Indianapolis. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Well, I have a question, and if the question is out of your purview or out of bounds, I'm sure you'll let me know. But I've always been curious about the comparison between dog intelligence and cat intelligence. Is one species more intelligent than the other? If not, if they're the same, how do they differ?
Well, I sometimes think that dogs are more intelligent than some people I know. But in answer to your question, I think that one thing is that dogs are generally more what they call biddable or trainable than cats. And part of that is because of the thousands of years of training, of breeding for animals that can be trained to certain tasks. In terms of pure intelligence, I really have no way to measure that. And if I said anything at all, I would get in trouble with the cat people. I don't have cats currently. I've had cats before. I sometimes comment that my favorite cat was a part Siamese who acted like a dog, and that she would walk with me when I walked the dogs, and when she got tired, she would get up on my shoulders and ride that way. On the other hand, she was a cat. She had her own unique way of going through the world. She was a tremendous ratter and mouser, and I wouldn't say that she was dumb. She had cat intelligence. She had a great deal of cat intelligence, just like the smartest dogs have dog intelligence. It's you can try to compare it, as some people do, to whatever level you would find in a human or in another animal, but I think that misses the boat. I think really the key thing is to try to understand what the animal's brain is like and how the animal is thinking, because it really does occupy a different perceptual universe, whether it's a dog or cat, than we do. It just goes through the world differently.
I have never gotten a definitive answer to that question, because I think most people fall into either the dog school or the cats. I mean, most people say, well, I'm a dog person, or I'm a cat person. And is there much history of cats serving functional purposes in society, such as, I used to say this jokingly, such as watch cats or guard cats or retriever cats?
Well, some people have taught their cats to retrieve. No, the cat is a completely different animal in that regard. I think its main utility early on was as a rodent killer. Cats are a lot smaller than dogs, for one thing, and they simply are not able physically to do many of the things that a dog does. Also, as I was trying to say earlier, they approach the world far, far differently than a dog. They haven't been selectively bred over thousands of years to be trainable the way dogs have. Whether they could be, I simply don't know. There are some people who would argue that cats are inherently more individual than dogs. And the important thing to remember here is that the dog is in essence a wolf, altered over thousands of years of selective breeding to live with humans and not wolves. But it comes from an animal that is highly social, whose social organization is very similar to that of the extended human family, and that you have the breeding pair, you have juveniles getting ready to leave, you have the young. It's a cooperative society, despite what people sometimes like to say about dominant alpha wolves. It's a cooperative society. And so, in many ways, it's a natural fit for the dogs and people. It's a different kind of relationship that evolved between them than with cats, which tend to be more solitary and have a completely different social structure.
Hmm. I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. You know, in this book, A Dog's History of America, you say that the Native American dog is gone, killed or mixed with those from Europe, and the dogs who came with the first waves of European settlers gone too. What can you tell us about the qualities of those dogs no longer with us?
Well, when you read the descriptions of the Native American dogs, there were a number of different varieties, something on the order of 17 varieties. They seemed to shake down into most dominant one was a common Indian dog, which by all accounts looked like a wolf. It was in many ways indistinguishable from a wolf, with the exception of a curved tail, which is one of the characteristics of a dog. They generally served just about every purpose you could imagine, or every purpose that the people required of them. And it's not fudging to say that different tribes used their dogs in different ways. Among the Plains Indians, before the advent of the horse, the dog, of course, was a beast of burden, primarily. It was a guardian. It was often figured in mythologies or in legends as a guide for the dead. And it was, in some of the tribes, not in all of them, but in some, it served as a food source, either for ceremonial purposes or in times of need, when things got lean in the winter. Some tribes used them for hunting, the dogs for hunting. And in South America, in Patagonia, people used the dogs to fish. And so the purpose changed according to the need. Of course, in the Arctic, they were transport animals. They drew sleds, and it was and carried would often pull walruses or seals out of the ice, you know, after they had been harpooned. So they would also be used to hunt polar bears.
Hmm.
So it's in the Arctic where the dog really achieved kind of mythic stature, even after the Europeans came here, when you have the polar explorations and the dog as the animal, really the heavy work animal who dragged these explorers to the pole. So those animals, the great debate right now is whether any of those original Indian dogs or Inuit or Eskimo dogs still exist. I remember some years ago I was in Alaska doing an article on the Alaskan Husky, which is the dog that pulls the sleds in the Iditarod and other dog sled races now. It's a mutt bred for racing. And talking to people there, trying to determine whether, in fact, any of the Eskimo dogs in the far north of Alaska could be considered to be pure anymore. Because when the gold rushes occurred, dogs were stolen by the boatload full from the lower 48 and shipped to Alaska to draw the sleds of the prospectors. And they mixed in with all those animals. There is some speculation that in some of the remote valleys of the Andes, there might be some quote-unquote pure aboriginal dogs. But that's not been proven yet.
Hmm. Prior to the arrival of Columbus and other European settlers, had dogs been used as weapons of war, to make war on people?
Well, certainly in the Caribbean and in Central and South America, where the conquest occurred, there was apparently no tradition whatsoever of using dogs against people. The Spaniards brought war dogs that were specially bred and trained for killing and maiming people, and they used them for that purpose in the conquest and starting in the Caribbean. It's virtually impossible to tell definitively how many people were killed in what we call the conquest, but the number was well into the hundreds of thousands and perhaps millions. Unfortunately, dogs played a role in that. They would be used to attack and in one case, at least, literally decapitate someone. In other cases, they would disembowel them or rip off limbs or otherwise kill them. The Spaniards would also have gladiatorial games between Indians and people, and sometimes just butcher Indians and feed them to their dogs. It really is a gruesome chapter, mm-hmm. and one that has had a far-reaching effect, I think, on attitudes, including those in North America, where a strong tradition arose of not using dogs really against Indians. There were some attempts to use them to track during war, but those usually faltered. There is simply there was a large distaste against it. Although dogs have been used in warfare in Europe and in parts of Asia for thousands of years.
Yeah, and we saw dogs turned on people during the civil rights movement recently here in our history.
And we saw dogs turned on people at Abu Ghraib,
right.
a prison. The interesting thing there is that there were five dog teams at the prison, and three handlers, refused to turn their dogs loose on people. And that barely has been reported, but I think it's significant because they refuse, saying that this is not what our dogs are trained for. And basically refused to dishonor a contract, as it were, that they had with their dogs, which is that if you're a responsible person with your dog, and I think this is whether you're in the military or just a citizen like you or I, you never ask your dog to do something that it's not capable of doing or that it's not trained to do or that you know to be wrong. It simply is a violation of the trust and the bond that people have with dogs, and usually it comes back to haunt you one way or the other.
Didn't George Washington, I can't remember now if I'm remembering this correctly or not, but didn't George Washington say, no, we're not going to use dogs for certain purposes, you know, at the outset of the Republic?
Well, George Washington had dogs, and he loved them. He refused to allow his slaves to have dogs, and that was common in the South. I don't recall that Washington himself, I may be wrong, made that decree, although he probably refused to use them in the military. John Quincy Adams simply rebelled, had a major fit on the floor of the Congress, as did many other people, when an attempt was made during the Seminole Wars in Florida in the 1830s to employ what were called Cuban bloodhounds, dogs raised to hunt runaway slaves against the Seminole Indians. And Zachary Taylor, who was the commanding general at the time in Florida, did initially flatly refuse an order to use the dogs. He finally employed them once in a futile search. They found something on the order of two people, and he simply shipped them back and refused to pay for them. So in that case, he did refuse to do that. And in fact, at that time, dogs, the whole business of hunting runaway slaves with dogs was a national scandal even then. And because people in the South would actually raise and train separate packs of dogs, which were used only for that purpose, only to track slaves who tried to escape.
Yeah, so here we have dogs helping to maintain slavery.
Well, unfortunately, the dog doesn't know how to pass that kind of judgment. The dog.
Right. I didn't mean to put it on the dog, but
no. In fact, when you look at it, the more you look at it, the more you realize that the history of dogs is, in fact, the history of people.
Yeah.
And the dog is. I do think that dogs, on occasion, will exercise good judgment, but you can't always count on it. I'd like to say that we're supposed to be the big-brained animal in the equation.
Yeah.
Humans are, but I don't think it always works that way.
Well, as you quote a man by the name of Charles Dudley Warner, the dog is everywhere what society makes him.
Exactly so. The dog is what society makes him, and we have an obligation, I think, in that regard to try and make the dog the best that we can. Unfortunately, as looking at the history shows, we haven't always achieved that, either for the dogs or for ourselves.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you for joining us this afternoon and talking with us, and thank you for writing this really fascinating history.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, Mark Durr. He is the author of A Dog's History of America, How Our Best Friend Explored, Conquered, and Settled a Continent. The book is published by North Point Press, the division of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks, Celeste. A big day at the Board of Trade today, Celeste, with the USDA reports released at 7:30 a.m. this morning. The numbers look like this. For total crop size, corn at 11.6 billion bushels. That's well above the average trade guess and what many thought the trade was thinking the marketplace was looking at 11.3 billion bushels. The corn market held together surprisingly well today, with the far deferred December going down a dime at one point, but everything else staying pretty strong throughout the day, only losing a 2.25 cents in that nearby December contract at 202.5 a settlement price there. We'll get to all the corn numbers momentarily. The bean number this morning at 3.1 billion bushels, surprising the trade, I believe, just about as much as anything, off 26 cents in the November contract. We'll talk all about those numbers during the closing market report this afternoon when we speak with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. And on hand with us, we'll talk with Joe Victor a little later in that program about 220-225. So stay with us. Joe, of course, with Allendale. You heard him on Commodity Week over the weekend. And he had some interesting things to talk about during that program about the size of the carryout. And if that number came out fairly large, that he was not really concerned that the price of beans would be in trouble. So we'll discuss the number with him because it did turn out to be a fairly large carryout number. Now, December wheat futures for the day, 311.5, the high, the low at 297, a settlement price at 311. They were up 8 cents at the end of the day. The March contract at 322, high, low at 308.5, a settlement price 321.75, up 6.75. May futures 326.5, the high, the low at 315, a settlement price at 326, up 7.5 cents. In July futures, 329.5, the high, the low at 318.5. Settlement price at 329, and they were up 6.75. Dease corn, 204.5, the high, the low at 197, settled at 202.5. They were down 2.25 as the day ended today. The March future, 215, the high, the low at 208.5. Settlement there, 213.25, down 2. In the May futures, 222.75 high, low at 215.5. Settlement price at 220.75, down 2 cents. By the way, if you want a complete look at the analysis segments that we've done already, as well as all the numbers from USDA, just go to our webpage at will.uiuc.edu. Click on AM on the left-hand side of the page and Agriculture on the right. Once you get to the Ag page, scroll down and hit subscribe. I'll send you out the newsletter that we released today with links to all kinds of analysis segments and a complete look at the numbers. So you can do that when you get the chance. July futures in the corn pit, 228.75, the high, the low at 221. Settlement price at 227, down 1.75. September, 234, the high, the low at 230. Settlement price, 233. They were off 1.5 for the day. And next year's Dease corn, this is the one that went down a dime at one point during the day, 242.5, the high, the low at 238. Their settlement price at 242.25, down 3/4. December oats, 144.5, the high, the low at 138.75. The settlement price there at 143.5, up 3/4 for the day. And the March contract in the oat pit at 150.5, high, low at 145, settled 150, up 1.5. Back on that corn number, that 11.6 billion bushels, if you're thinking about that number, that was really big. 10.9 was the last time around the trade, thinking maybe it was moving around 10.3. If all went the way everybody thought it should, every 100 million bushels extra that's raised, about a dime lower in the price, but they held together in the corn pit really well today. Soybeans now, 517 under pressure today for the high, the low at 506, settled 513, off 26 cents. January futures, 524 the high, the low at 514.5, settlement price at 521.75, down 26. March 531.5, the high, the low at 523, settled 528. They were off 25.75 cents on that 3.1 billion bushel estimate from USDA this morning. May futures, 539, the high, the low at 530, settled 536, off 24.5 cents. In July, 545.5, the high, the low at 538, settlement there at 543.75. They were down 23.5. August beans, 544, the high, next year's low at 541, and the August at 544. 54, down 22 at the end of the day. October bean meal, 154, the high, the low at 151, settled 153.30, off 750, and the Dease contract at 156.50, high, low at 153.40, settled 155.40 for the December bean meal, down 790. October bean oil, 20.30, the high, low at 1970, settled 1980. They were off 115 for the day. And December bean oil, 2019, the high, the low at 1980, settlement price at 1998. And they were off 97 cents at the end of the day. Now here with the numbers from the less active Mercantile Exchange is Celeste Quinn. Celeste?
Okay, well, feeder cattle, live cattle finished higher today, and it was another lower day today for lean hogs and February bellies. October feeder cattle, 114.75, the high, 113.90, the low, 114.25, the settlement, that up 77.5. November, 113.50, the high, 112.75, the low, 113, even the settlement, that up a dollar even. January, 110.15, the high, 109.55, the low, the settlement, 109.70, that up 80. October live cattle, 87.40, the high 86.65, the low 86.77.5, the settlement, that up 37.5. December 89.47.5, the high 88.65, the low 88.72.5, the settlement, that up a nickel. October lean hogs, 72.10, the high 71.40, the low 71.70, the settlement, that down 40. December, 66 even the high, 64.30 the low, 64.30 the settlement, and that down the limit, down $2. February, lean hogs, 65.32.5 the high, 63.85 the low, finishing at 64.05, down 157.5. April, lean hogs, 63.35 the high, 61.95 the low, 61.97.5 the settlement, that down 177.5. And February bellies, 96.20 the high, 94.05 the low, 94.20 the settlement, that down 130. The Dow is currently up 10 points at 10,092. The NASDAQ is off a point at 1927, and the S&P 500 off a point at 1123.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
John Baber from San Diego, California writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why are there only 5 isomorphism classes of groups of order 8?
Nobody could figure out what 8-order isomorphism was long enough to put it in more than 5 classes. The International Society of Lonely Geeks ran an ad for 2 consecutive years, but only got one response from the same person that came up with the first 5 classes. A very thin woman dressed in black offered to create 6 classes of order 5, but the society wasn't interested in